Chapter 4. Meetings, the medium of managerial work. Meetings have a bad name. One school of management thought considers them the curse of the manager's existence. Someone who did a study found that managers spend up to 50% of their time in meetings, and implied that this was time wasted. Peter Drucker once said that spending more than 25% of his time in meetings is a sign of a manager's malorganization. And William H. White, Jr., in his book The Organization Man, described meetings as non-contributory labor that managers must endure. But there is another way to regard meetings. Earlier, we said that a big part of a middle manager's work is to supply information and know-how, and to impart a sense of the preferred method of handling things to the groups under his control and influence. A manager also makes and helps to make decisions. Both kinds of basic managerial tasks can only occur during face-to-face encounters, and therefore only during meetings. Thus, I will assert again that a meeting is nothing less than the medium through which managerial work is performed. That means we should not be fighting their very existence, but rather using the time spent in them as efficiently as possible. The two basic managerial roles produce two basic kinds of meetings. In the first kind of meeting, called a process-oriented meeting, knowledge is shared and information is exchanged. Such meetings take place on a regularly scheduled basis. The purpose of the second kind of meeting is to solve a specific problem. Meetings of this sort, called mission-oriented, frequently produce a decision. They are ad hoc affairs, not scheduled long in advance, because they usually can't be. Process-oriented meetings. To make the most of this kind of meeting, we should aim to infuse it with regularity. In other words, the people attending should know how the meeting is run, what kinds of substantive matters are discussed, and what is to be accomplished. It should be designed to allow a manager to batch transactions, to use the same production, setup time, and effort to take care of many similar managerial tasks. Moreover, given the regularity, you and the others attending can begin to forecast the time required for the kinds of work to be done. Hence, a production control system, as recorded on various calendars, can take shape, which means that a scheduled meeting will have minimum impact on other things people are doing. At Intel, we use three kinds of process-oriented meetings: the one-on-one, the staff meeting, and the operation review. One-on-ones. At Intel, a one-on-one is a meeting between a supervisor and a subordinate, and it is the principal way their business relationship is maintained. Its main purpose is mutual teaching and exchange of information. By talking about specific problems and situations, the supervisor teaches the subordinate his skills and know-how, and suggests ways to approach things. At the same time, the subordinate provides the supervisor with detailed information about what he is doing and what he is concerned about. From what I can tell, regularly scheduled one-on-ones are highly unusual outside of Intel. When I ask a manager from another company about the practice, I usually get an, "Oh no, I don't need scheduled meetings with my supervisor or subordinate. I see him several times a day." But there is an enormous difference between a casual encounter by a supervisor and a subordinate, or even a meeting, mission-oriented, to resolve a specific problem, and a one-on-one. When Intel was a young company, I realized that even though I was expected to supervise both engineering and manufacturing, I knew very little about the company's first product line, memory devices. I also didn't know much about manufacturing techniques, my background having been entirely in semiconductor device research. So two of my associates, both of whom reported to me, agreed to give me private lessons on memory design and manufacturing. These took place by appointment and involved a teacher subordinate preparing for each. During the session, the pupil supervisor busily took notes, trying to learn. As intel grew, the initial tone and spirit of such one-on-ones endured and grew. Who should have a one-on-one? In some situations, a supervisor should perhaps meet with all those who work under him, from professionals to production operators. But here, I want to talk about one-on-ones between a supervisor and each of the professionals who report to him directly. How often should you have one-on-ones? Or put another way, how do you decide how often somebody needs such a meeting? The answer is the job or task-relevant maturity of each of your subordinates. In other words, how much experience does a given subordinate have with the specific task at hand? This is not the same as the experience he has in general, or how old he is. As we will see later, the most effective management style in a specific instance varies from very close to very loose supervision as a subordinate's task maturity increases. Accordingly, you should have one-on-ones frequently, for example, once a week, with a subordinate who is inexperienced in a specific situation, and less frequently, perhaps once every few weeks, with an experienced veteran. Another consideration here is how quickly things change in a job area. In marketing, for example, the pace may be so rapid that a supervisor needs to have frequent one-on-ones to keep current on what's happening. But in a research environment, life may be quieter, and for a given level of task-relevant maturity, less frequent meetings may suffice. How long should a one-on-one meeting last? There really is no answer to this, but the subordinate must feel that there is enough time to broach and get into thorny issues. Look at it this way. If you had a big problem that you wanted to kick around with your supervisor, the person whose professional interest in the matter is second only to yours, would you want to bring it up in a meeting scheduled to last only 15 minutes? You would not. I feel that a one-on-one should last an hour at a minimum. Anything less, in my experience, tends to make the subordinate confine himself to simple things that can be handled quickly. Where should a one-on-one take place? In the supervisor's office, in the subordinate's office, or somewhere else? I think you should have the meeting in or near the subordinate's work area if possible. A supervisor can learn a lot simply by going to his subordinate's office. Is he organized or not? Does he repeatedly have to spend time looking for a document he wants? Does he get interrupted all the time? Never? And in general, how does the subordinate approach his work? A key point about a one-on-one: it should be regarded as the subordinate's meeting, with its agenda and tone set by him. There's good reason for this. Somebody needs to prepare for the meeting. The supervisor with 8 subordinates would have to prepare 8 times, the subordinate only once. So the latter should be asked to prepare an outline, which is very important because it forces him to think through in advance all of the issues and points he plans to raise. Moreover, with an outline, the supervisor knows at the outset what is to be covered and can therefore help to set the pace of the meeting according to the meatiness of the items on the agenda. An outline also provides a framework for supporting information, which the subordinate should prepare in advance. The subordinate should then walk the supervisor through all the material. What should be covered in a one-on-one? We can start with performance figures, indicators used by the subordinate, such as incoming order rates, production output, or project status. Emphasis should be on indicators that signal trouble. The meeting should also cover anything important that has happened since the last meeting: current hiring problems, people problems in general, organizational problems, and future plans, and, very, very important, potential problems. Even when a problem isn't tangible, even if it's only an intuition that something's wrong, a subordinate owes it to his supervisor to tell him. because it triggers a look into the organizational black box. The most important criterion governing matters to be talked about is that they be issues that preoccupy and nag the subordinate. These are often obscure and take time to surface, consider, and resolve. What is the role of the supervisor in a one-on-one? He should facilitate the subordinate's expression of what's going on and what's bothering him. The supervisor is there to learn and to coach. Peter Drucker sums up the supervisor's job here very nicely. The good time users among managers do not talk to their subordinates about their problems, but they know how to make the subordinates talk about theirs. How is this done? By applying Grove's principle of didactic management. Ask one more question. When the supervisor thinks the subordinate has said all he wants to about a subject, he should ask another question. He should try to keep the flow of thoughts coming by prompting the subordinate with queries until both feel satisfied that they have gotten to the bottom of a problem. I'd like to suggest some mechanical hints for effective one-on-one meetings. First, both the supervisor and subordinate should have a copy of the outline and both should take notes on it, which serves a number of purposes. I take notes in just about all circumstances, and most often end up never looking at them again. I do it to keep my mind from drifting, and also to help me digest the information I hear and see. Since I take notes in outline form, I'm forced to categorize the information logically, which helps me to absorb it. Equally important is what writing it down symbolizes. Many issues in a one-on-one lead to action required on the part of the subordinate. When he takes a note immediately following the supervisor's suggestion, the act implies a commitment, like a handshake, that something will be done. The supervisor, also having taken notes, can then follow up at the next one-on-one. A real time saver is using a hold file, where both the supervisor and subordinate accumulate important but not altogether urgent issues for discussion at the next meeting. This kind of file applies the production principle of batching and saves time for both involved by minimizing the need for ad hoc contact, like phone calls, drop-in visits, and so on, which constitute the interruptions we considered earlier. The supervisor should also encourage the discussion of heart-to-heart issues during one-on-ones, because this is the perfect forum for getting at subtle and deep work-related problems affecting his subordinate. Is he satisfied with his own performance? Does some frustration or obstacle gnaw at him? Does he have doubts about where he is going? But the supervisor should be wary of the zinger, which is a heart-to-heart issue brought up at an awkward time. More often than not, these come near the end of a meeting. If you let that happen, the subordinate might tell you something like he's unhappy and has been looking outside for a job, and give you only 5 minutes to deal with it. Long-distance telephone one-on-ones have become necessary because many organizations are now spread out geographically. But these can work well enough with proper preparation and attention. The supervisor must have the outline before the meeting begins. Both parties should take notes, and so on. Because you can't see the other participant in the meeting, note-taking can't work in the same way as in a face-to-face meeting. Exchanging notes after the meeting is a way to make sure each knows what the other committed himself to do. One-on-ones should be scheduled on a rolling basis, setting up the next one as the meeting taking place ends. Other commitments can thereby be taken into account and cancellations avoided. If the supervisor uses a set schedule for a one-on-one, such as every second Wednesday morning, and if the subordinate's vacation happens to fall on that date, the meeting is not going to occur. By scheduling on a rolling basis, this can be easily avoided. What is the leverage of the one-on-one? Let's say you have a one-on-one with your subordinate every 2 weeks, and it lasts 1.5 hours. 90 minutes of your time can enhance the quality of your subordinate's work for 2 weeks, or for some 80-plus hours, and also upgrade your understanding of what he's doing. Clearly, one-on-ones can exert enormous leverage. This happens through the development of a common base of information and similar ways of doing and handling things between the supervisor and the subordinate. And this, as noted, is the only way in which efficient and effective delegation can take place. At the same time, the subordinate teaches the supervisor, and what is learned is absolutely essential if the supervisor is to make good decisions. During a recent one-on-one meeting, my subordinate, who is responsible for Intel's sales organization, reviewed trend indicators of incoming orders. While I was vaguely familiar with them, he laid out a lot of specific information and convinced me that our business had stopped growing. Even though the summer is typically slow, he proved to me that what was going on was not just seasonal. After we pondered the data for a while and considered their relationship to other indicators of business activity in our industry, we came to the reluctant conclusion that business was, in fact, slowing down. This meant we should take a conservative approach to near-term investment. No small matter. By sharing his base of information with me, the two of us developed a congruent attitude, approach, and conclusion. Conservatism in our expansion plans. He left the meeting having decided to scale back growth in his own area of responsibility. I left having decided to share what we had concluded with the business groups I supervised. Thus, this one-on-one produced substantial leverage. The Intel sales manager affected all the other managers who reported to me. To digress a bit, I also think that one-on-ones at home can help family life. As the father of two teenage daughters, I have found that the conversation in such a time together is very different in tone and kind from what we say to each other in other circumstances. The one-on-one makes each of us take the other seriously and allows subtle and complicated matters to come up for discussion. Obviously, no notes are taken, as father and daughter usually go out for dinner at a restaurant, but a family one-on-one very much resembles a business one-on-one. I strongly recommend both practices. Staff meetings. A staff meeting is one in which a supervisor and all of his subordinates participate, and which therefore presents an opportunity for interaction among peers. As we will see later, peer interaction, especially decision-making by a group of peers, is not easy. Yet, it is key to good management. The approach to decision-making that we advocate in the next chapter, as well as the workings of the principle of dual reporting, Chapter 9, depend on a group of peers working well together. By learning how this happens in staff meetings, where a group of peers get to know each other, and where the presence of a common supervisor helps peer interaction to develop, managers will be prepared to be members of other working bodies based on peer groups. Staff meetings also create opportunities for the supervisor to learn from the exchange and confrontation that often develops. In my own case, I get a much better understanding of an issue with which I am not familiar by listening to two people with opposing views discuss it than I do by listening to one side only. My first experience with staff meetings dates back to my early professional years when I was the head of a small group of engineers doing semiconductor device research. Everyone in this group worked on an isolated aspect of a problem or on a different problem altogether. I was supposed to be the supervisor, but I found that others in the group were often more familiar with the work of another researcher than I was. Thus, a group discussion on any subject tended to get more detailed and more heated, but always more rewarding than an exchange between me and one other specialist. What should be discussed at a staff meeting? Anything that affects more than two of the people present. If the meeting degenerates into a conversation between two people working on a problem affecting only them, the supervisor should break it off and move on to something else that will include more of the staff, while suggesting that the two continue their exchange later. How structured should the meeting be? A free-for-all brainstorming session or controlled with a detailed agenda? It should be mostly controlled, with an agenda issued far enough in advance that the subordinates will have had the chance to prepare their thoughts for the meeting. But it should also include an open session, a designated period of time for the staff to bring up anything they want. This is when a varied set of housekeeping matters can be disposed of, as well as when important issues can be given a tentative first look. If it is justified, you can provide time for a more formal discussion about an issue in the scheduled portion of a future meeting. What is the role of the supervisor in the staff meeting? A leader? Observer? Expediter? Questioner? Decision maker? The answer, of course, is all of them. Please note that lecturer is not listed. A supervisor should never use staff meetings to pontificate, which is the surest way to undermine free discussion, and hence the meeting's basic purpose. A supervisor's most important roles are being a meeting's moderator and facilitator, and controller of its pace and thrust. Ideally, the supervisor should keep things on track, with the subordinates bearing the brunt of working the issues. Staff meetings are an ideal medium for decision-making, because the group of managers present has typically worked together for a long time. The formal, as well as informal, authority of each individual has been well established, and everybody knows who likes to spout off, who tends to daydream, who knows what stuff, and so on. A staff meeting is like the dinner table conversation of a family, while other forms of interaction at work, involving people who don't know each other very well, are like a group of strangers having to make a decision together. Operation reviews. This is the medium of interaction for people who don't otherwise have much opportunity to deal with one another. The format here should include formal presentations in which managers describe their work to other managers who are not their immediate supervisors and to peers in other parts of the company. The basic purpose of an operation review at Intel is to keep the teaching and learning going on between employees several organizational levels apart, people who don't have one-on-ones or staff meetings with each other. This is important for both the junior and senior manager. The junior person will benefit from the comments, criticisms, and suggestions of the senior manager, who in turn will get a different feel for problems from people familiar with their details. Such meetings are also a source of motivation. Managers making the presentations will want to leave a good impression on their supervisor's supervisor and on their outside peers. Who are the players in an operation review? The organizing manager, the reviewing manager, the presenters, and the audience. Each of these players has a distinct role to play if the review is to be a useful one. The supervisor of the presenting managers, an Intel divisional marketing manager, let's say, should organize the meeting. He should help the presenters decide what issues should be talked about and what should not, what should be emphasized, and what level of detail to go into. The supervisor should also be in charge of housekeeping, the meeting room, visual materials, invitations, and so on. Finally, he should be the timekeeper, scheduling the presentations and keeping them moving along. Though it's hard to judge in advance the time needed for any discussion, the supervisor has presumably had more experience running meetings. In any case, he should pace the presenters using inconspicuous gestures, so that the manager talking doesn't suddenly find himself out of time with only half his points covered. The reviewing manager is the senior supervisor at whom the review is aimed, like the general manager of an Intel division. He has a very important, although more subtle, role to play. He should ask questions, make comments, and in general, impart the appropriate spirit to the meeting. He is the catalyst needed to provoke audience participation, and by his example, he should encourage free expression. He should never preview the material, since that will keep him from reacting spontaneously. Because the senior supervisor is a role model for the junior managers present, he should take his role at the review extremely seriously. The people presenting the reviews, a group of marketing supervisors, for example, should use visual aids such as overhead transparencies to the extent possible. People are endowed with eyes as well as ears, and the simultaneous use of both definitely helps the audience understand the points being made. But care must be taken because all too frequently, a presenter gets so obsessed with getting through all of his visual material that his message gets lost, even while all his charts get flipped. As a rule of thumb, I would recommend 4 minutes of presentation and discussion time per visual aid, which can include tables, numbers, or graphics. The presenter must highlight whatever he wants to emphasize with a color, pen, or pointer. Throughout, a presenter has to watch his audience like a hawk. Facial expressions and body language, among other things, will tell him if people are getting the message, if he needs to stop and go over something again, or if he is boring them and should speed up. The audience in an operation review also has a crucial part to play. One of the distinguishing marks of a good meeting is that the audience participates by asking questions and making comments. If you avoid the presenter's eyes, yawn, or read the newspaper, it's worse than not being there at all. Lack of interest undermines the confidence of the presenter. Remember that you are spending a big part of your working day at the review. Make that time as valuable for yourself and your organization as you can. Pay attention and jot down things you've heard that you might try. Ask questions if something is not clear to you, and speak up if you can't go along with an approach being recommended. And if a presenter makes a factual error, it is your responsibility to go on record. Remember, you are being paid to attend the meeting, which is not meant to be a siesta in the midst of an otherwise busy day. Regard attendance at the meeting for what it is: work. Mission-oriented meetings. Unlike a process-oriented meeting, which is a regularly scheduled affair held to exchange knowledge and information, the mission-oriented meeting is usually held ad hoc and is designed to produce a specific output, frequently a decision. The key to success here is what the chairman does. Very often, no one is officially given that title, but by whatever name, one person usually has more at stake in the outcome of the meeting than others. In fact, it is usually the chairman, or the de facto chairman, who calls the meeting, and most of what he contributes should occur before it begins. All too often, he shows up as if he were just another attendee and hopes that things will develop as he wants. When a mission-oriented meeting fails to accomplish the purpose for which it was called, the blame belongs to the chairman. Thus, the chairman must have a clear understanding of the meeting's objective, what needs to happen, and what decision has to be made. The absolute truth is that if you don't know what you want, you won't get it. So before calling a meeting, ask yourself, what am I trying to accomplish? Then ask, is a meeting necessary? Or desirable? Or justifiable? Don't call a meeting if all the answers aren't yes. An estimate of the dollar cost of a manager's time, including overhead, is about $100 per hour. So a meeting involving 10 managers for 2 hours costs the company $2,000. Most expenditures of $2,000 have to be approved in advance by senior people, like buying a copying machine or making a transatlantic trip. Yet a manager can call a meeting and commit $2,000 worth of managerial resources at a whim. So even if you're just an invited participant, you should ask yourself if the meeting and your attendance is desirable and justified. Tell the chairman, the person who invited you, if you do not feel it is. Determine the purpose of a meeting before committing your time and your company's resources. Get it called off early, at a low value-added stage, if a meeting makes no sense. And find a less costly way, a one-on-one meeting, a telephone call, a note, to pursue the matter. Assuming the meeting does need to be held, the chairman faces a set of obligations. The first one has to do with attendance. As the chairman, you must identify who should attend and then try to get those people to come. It is not enough to ask people and hope for the best. You need to follow up and get commitments. If someone invited can't make it himself, see to it that he sends a person with the power to speak for him. Keep in mind that a meeting called to make a specific decision is hard to keep moving if more than 6 or 7 people attend. 8 people should be the absolute cutoff. Decision-making is not a spectator sport because onlookers get in the way of what needs to be done. The chairman is also responsible for maintaining discipline. It is criminal for him to allow people to be late and waste everyone's time. Remember, wasting time here really means that you are wasting the company's money, with the meter ticking away at the rate of $100 per hour per person. Do not worry about confronting the late arriver. Just as you would not permit a fellow employee to steal a piece of office equipment worth $2,000, you shouldn't let anyone walk away with the time of his fellow managers. The chairman should finally be responsible for logistical matters. He should, for example, make sure that all necessary and audiovisual equipment is present in the meeting room. He should also send out an agenda that clearly states the purpose of the meeting, as well as what role everybody there is expected to play to get the desired output. Here's an example of such an agenda. 2. Far East Plant Manager, Manufacturing Manager, Corporate Construction Manager, President. From Far East Construction Manager. Subject: Philippines Plant Location Decision Meeting. Friday, October 1st, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Santa Clara Conference Room, 212. Teleconference connection to Phoenix Conference Room 4. Purpose of meeting: to decide specific location for Philippine plant expansion. Agenda: 11 to 11:30, manufacturing considerations, FE plant manager. 11:30 to 12, construction considerations, FE construction manager. 12 o'clock to 12:45, review of alternatives, including preferred choice, FE construction manager. 12:45 to 1 o'clock, discussion, all. You can also see this in the PDF. This may sound like too much regimentation for you, but whether it's that or needed discipline depends on your point of view. If the chairman forces you to show up at a meeting prepared and on time, you might consider him a drill sergeant. But if you show up on time, ready to work, and someone else doesn't and isn't, you'll probably begrudge the person responsible for wasting your time. It must be much the same in an operating room. Some people working there may not like a surgeon insisting upon precision. But I am one patient who would much prefer a disciplined operating room to any other kind. Once the meeting is over, the chairman must nail down exactly what happened by sending out minutes that summarize the discussion that occurred, the decision made, and the actions to be taken. And it's very important that attendees get the minutes quickly, before they forget what happened. The minutes should also be as clear and as specific as possible, telling the reader what is to be done, who is to do it, and when. All this may seem like too much trouble, but if the meeting was worth calling in the first place, the work needed to produce the minutes is a small additional investment, an activity with high leverage, to ensure that the full benefit is obtained from what was done. Ideally, a manager should never have to call an ad hoc mission-oriented meeting, because if all runs smoothly, everything is taken care of in regularly scheduled process-oriented meetings. In practice, however, if all goes well, routine meetings will take care of maybe 80% of the problems and issues. The remaining 20% will still have to be dealt with in mission-oriented meetings. Remember, Peter Drucker said that if people spend more than 25% of their time in meetings, it is a sign of malorganization. I would put it another way. The real sign of malorganization is when people spend more than 25% of their time in ad hoc, mission-oriented meetings.